Starts everywhere January 19th.
Well, good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lurie. Coming up, we're going to hear a segment of Florida This Week, and later on, we'll hear a little bit of what Oprah Winfrey said yesterday at the Golden Globes Awards, and we'll also hear a really interesting interview with a Trump official on CNN yesterday. That's all coming up. First, one listener comment about last Friday's program. Last Friday, among the topics we covered, new declarations by Attorney General Jeff Sessions on how the federal government was going to treat states that have okayed medical marijuana or recreational marijuana. After the show, after we heard from a local expert who represents marijuana businesses, we heard this from one listener.
This is Kevin from Bradenton. I'd just like to leave a couple of comments about today's show with Richard Blau speaking on cannabis. First of all, I'd also like to point out that jobs that actually are decent paying jobs with benefits, including health care, are one reason that I'm in favor of this market for medical cannabis progressing rather than, you know, allowing the cartels to have a monopoly on the money that's being made. And the proof is, you know, I worked in the industry out in Colorado, and it's easy to make more money once you've been there a while if you're willing to work hard and move up. But the other thing I really wanted to bring up was some of the things that he talked about today. Well, I agree with him about the driving under the influence of cannabis, and we all should be concerned about this. But the fact that there isn't a viable test available is more due to the fact that there's hardly any money for funding, since this is a federally illegal drug, and no scientific group is going to be able to come up with that test unless there's funding for that. So I think it's going to be difficult. I don't think that it's impossible. I believe with today's technology that it can be worked out if there's proper funding. And then the other thing I'd like to bring up is the scientific data on cannabis use among adolescents. Adolescents are going to do what they do, and they will use cannabis whether it's legal or not. As far as it encouraging people to use it more, it's just going to be like alcohol. You got to prevent the people that aren't using it by regulating it and treating it like alcohol. And then finally, the other thing that he mentioned was that 71% of the people, you know, he claimed that in the state of Florida, that the issue of cannabis and legalization is still has a divided a lot of people. Well, I would say that most of the people that he's speaking about, the groups that he talked to, were more than likely very much older people than the younger people in this state. And those older people have been around longer, so they've been fed the propaganda for decades that's dripped down, and it's demonized this cannabis product that can be used by sick people to make themselves feel better and possibly even have a better hold on their health. Lastly, the issue about scientific data comes up once again, and in my opinion, if there was funding, then we could actually find out some of these things. But, for example, the legislature decided that in our case in Florida, vaping is the preferable method for delivery. Well, if it is a healthier alternative, then I'd like to see some science behind that. But my opinion is that it's probably a bigger monetary gain for the people that are pushing it in that way, just like the fact that it's illegal is also something that's been used for years to help prop up the private prison industry. And since it's a product that is easy for people to use without spending too much money, it's not something that the pharmaceutical industry can make money on. Rob, I thank you for your time, and I hope that you guys continue to cover this important topic.
Well, there you have a listener comment that came in after last Friday's program. One of the segments last Friday was about marijuana and the new pronouncement by the Attorney General of the U.S. Coming up, we're going to hear Florida This Week. As we listen to it, please feel free to comment. You can email us at dj@wmnf.org with your comments. We're going to hear Florida This Week, a discussion about state and local politics that airs on the PBS station WEDU. And among the topics this week, a brand new entrant in the race for governor this year, somebody that has a lot of powerful money behind him and could be one of the front runners for governor. So listen up. Here's Florida This Week from this past Friday night. Coming up next, President Trump wants to open up more of the eastern Gulf of Mexico to oil drilling. Some of the biggest Republican donors in the country have indicated their choice for governor this year, and it's not Adam Putnam. Unions are fearful of a bill that's slated for consideration when the legislative session begins next week, and Florida's GOP chair is facing a primary challenge for his House seat. Political Insights next on Florida This Week.
WEDU Studios, this is Florida This Week. And now, moderator Rob Lori.
Welcome back. This week our panelists are State Senator Jeff Brandis is from District 24. He's a Republican. State Representative Sean Shaw is from District 61. He's a Democrat. Dr. Susan McManus is a distinguished university professor of public administration and political science at USF in Tampa. And Ernest Hooper is a WEDU host and a columnist at the Tampa Bay Times. Well, it's great to see you. Thank you for coming.
It's great to be here.
Well, the Trump administration is proposing to open up almost all U.S. coastal waters to oil drilling, including those in the eastern Gulf of Mexico and off Florida's Atlantic coast, where activists have fought for decades to try to protect delicate ecosystems from oil spills. Trump had campaigned on expanding oil drilling here in the U.S. The announcement of the proposed drilling expansion drew criticism from all of Florida's major environmental groups. Senator Bill Nelson called it an assault on Florida's economy and on the will of the public and the environment. He said the proposal defies all common sense, and he'll do everything, he says, to defeat it. Even Governor Rick Scott, a longtime backer of Donald Trump's, opposes the idea and says he'll meet with Interior Secretary Zink to discuss the concern that he has with the drilling plan. So, Susan, when the president campaigned, he said if we drill in all these places across the U.S., we could produce more oil than Saudi Arabia. That was one of the things that he campaigned on. What do you think about this plan?
It's absolutely pathetic timing if you're a Republican running for office in Florida. And we know from tracking attitudes about oil spills and drilling and all that, that when gas prices are really high is when people say drill, drill, drill. But right now gas prices are very low, the economy's well. And so that is not the usual situation that helps you get something through. But secondly, Republicans, like Democrats, know that we have now an environmental generation. Gen X and the millennials are huge proponents of pro-environmental policies of all types. They're against it. They're to the point now in terms of number of registered voters that they can tip elections. And finally, I'll say that Republicans in Florida, compared to a lot of other Republicans in other states, have for years, going way back to Martinez's days, been much more moderate on environmental issues. After all, people move to Florida for our environment, including Republicans.
Jeff, do you think this presents any problems for President Trump in Florida, or what do you make of his idea?
No, I think, I represent a community that's along the beaches. I think this is an area that there is kind of broad bipartisan support against oil drilling off the coast of Florida. I don't think that there's any discussion, meaningful discussion at the state level, and I think that you will see a unified bipartisan opposition to any discussion about oil drilling off the coast.
And Sean, that's true. I mean, Marco Rubio has come out against this. Brian Mass, the congressman, came out against this. So did the governor. So a lot of Republicans are speaking out against this idea.
Right. I mean, Governor Scott and Senator Nelson agree on this. That ought to tell you how bipartisan it is. And in the legislature, you know, we have bipartisan support on the no fracking. And so this is certainly something that we have to protect Florida's greatest resource, which is her environment. And as Dr. McManus said, this is terrible timing, a terrible policy, but coming from the administration that's up in D.C., it's not surprising.
And Ernest, what do you make of it?
Well, I'm just looking forward to
seeing Florida rally against this. I think if there was a presidential policy that went against the Rockies, everyone in Colorado would be against it. If there was a policy that threatened the Grand Canyon, everyone in Arizona would be against it. And I think not only are we talking about tourism and our beaches, but we're talking about our fishing industry. We're really talking about it in our entire ecosystem. And if it's possible that an oil spill could put all of that in danger, you have to be opposed to it. And that possibility exists. I think some of the proponents argue that the technology is better. But just last week, the president rolled back some requirements that President Obama had put in place after Deepwater Horizon. So I think this is a policy that we're going to see Floridians rally against, and it'll be interesting. I know we're going to talk about Ron DeSantis later. It'll be interesting to see how that impacts his campaign.
And Susan, one last question. Does this protect, with Governor Scott coming out so quickly and criticizing President Trump, or at least saying he disagrees with President Trump on this issue, does this protect him if he chooses to run for U.S. Senate? Does this inoculate him by coming out so quickly?
Well, it can't 100% inoculate, because in the past he has made statements where he was more in favor of it. But again, the timing was different. He'll still have to deal with people who will call back the times when he was in favor of opening up oil drilling. But the bottom line here, and this is a common theme, is in Florida, we're a pro-environmental state now. There's no turning back. That's both parties. That's independents. That's all age groups. And in a way, Trump has already said today he is pretty much letting Scott and Republicans do what they want in Florida. He has to, or he'll never win re-election as a president.
And the survey that you had, the Sunshine State survey, shows this over and over again, that Floridians are very pro-environment.
Absolutely. Oil drilling, ironically, at the time we did this survey, it's the USF Nielsen Sunshine State Survey, oil drilling was not the number one environmental issue.
Well,
it's actually overbuilding. And also, secondly, water-related things. Oil drilling was very low on the list. But all you have to do is talk about the possibilities of doing it, and suddenly I guarantee if we were to do the survey tomorrow, it would be elevated to the top of the list.
Okay. Well, a Northeast Florida congressman who has the backing of President Trump is jumping into the crowded contest for Florida governor.
Representative Ron DeSantis is entering the race 2 weeks after Trump tweeted that DeSantis is a brilliant young leader who would make a great governor. Some of the Republican Party's largest donors are already on board: hedge fund heiress Rebecca Mercer, casino magnate Sheldon Adelson, and investment tycoon Foster Freeze. The 39-year-old DeSantis is a U.S. Navy veteran and a graduate of both Yale and Harvard, who has represented a Northeast Florida congressional district since 2013. DeSantis took a swipe at other Republicans in his initial campaign announcement. He said he would drain the swamp in Tallahassee that needs to be drained. Republicans have controlled Tallahassee for the last 20 years.
So, Sean, if he's going to be win the Republican primary, he's got to go through Adam Putnam and perhaps Richard Corcoran, the Speaker of the House. Who do you like in that matchup, three-way? Not that, because you're a Democrat, but if you were to predict the winner,
right?
What would you say?
That is a tough one. I think I would predict at this point Putnam, because I think Congressman DeSantis and the Speaker Corcoran are going to be going for a lot of the same voters. You know, this is really, if I were Speaker Corcoran, I would not be pleased with DeSantis getting in the race, given that they both are extremely conservative. But what is interesting is him, DeSantis, how he's framing his entrance into the race by draining the swamp. As you said, Republicans have been in charge 20 years. You know, so to come into the race by saying you're going to drain the swamp is somewhat disingenuous, I believe. And I don't think that a congressman who is not in Tallahassee is the best person to be trying to spout this message of being an outsider who's going to drain the swamp in Tallahassee. I think that ought to be coming from someone else, not DeSantis. It's a bit disingenuous for him to enter into the race with that kind of commentary.
Whereas with Sheldon Adelson and the Mercer family being backers of DeSantis, these are big names in Republican fundraising. It almost makes him the 800-pound gorilla in a three-way race. Susan's saying no, but I want to get to you in a second. But
well, I mean, I think it's going to benefit him. But, you know, Adam Putnam has gotten off to a huge start. He's raised a lot of money. He's been seen as the quote-unquote next governor for at least 2, 3, 4 years. I mean, there were a lot of people who were surprised that he didn't challenge Rick Scott when Rick Scott first ran. So I still see Putnam as the front runner. I think, you know, the primary will be a challenge, and but I think he's going to be able to manage that.
Mm-hmm. Susan, you were shaking your head no when I said the money people who are backing DeSantis are important to winning a primary. Why did you shake your head?
I shook my head because the idea that outsiders can come in and buy a local race or something is very, it's not one that resonates like it used to. And the money, that kind of approach is different when it's a presidential race. It doesn't really work that well when it's a local race. I can see the ads against him right now for running, for relying on outside money from all these other places when it's Floridians who a governor has to deal with, how their taxes are spent, how they're raised, and so forth. You know, governor's races are more localistic than they are nationalized, even though obviously DeSantis is banking on the fact that he can nationalize it and that Trump is the winning ticket. We'll see. That's a long way till November.
Yeah, oh. Ask Rick Baker if Trump can
if you can
carry
but
you
St.
to
Petersburg
victory.
But St. Petersburg is different than the state of Florida.
True, but we'll see.
Well, Susan, I want to ask you about whether or not DeSantis, if DeSantis is relying on this out-of-state money, doesn't it show that the hardcore conservatives, though, in the Republican Party don't like Putnam? And if Corcoran's name has been mentioned, they're not rallying behind Corcoran. And DeSantis has been on Fox News a lot, too. So,
well, I think that's the connection, is the national connection. And to say that hardcore Republicans don't like Adam Putnam, I think, is really not a fair statement at all. If anything, and this sounds odd coming from an academic, would I rather go on the campaign trail in Central and North Florida in a Republican primary and say I went to the University of Florida or Harvard and Yale?
Yeah.
I mean, these are, you know, this is all politics is local, really comes into play in, you know, non-presidential election years. And I see it that way in the governor's race. DeSantis, however, his strongest asset is clearly his military service and the fact that he has a platform and he can espouse things and get more media attention. That's free media. That's you know, mm-hmm. not even money that's dependent or time that's dependent upon these rich people from other places. I just think you got to be careful as a candidate in a non-presidential year from looking like outsiders or you know, calling all the shots.
Well, Jeff, what do you make of? I mean, I'm still wondering why DeSantis gets in then. If Susan's right that Floridians don't like outsiders coming in to tell them how to vote, why would DeSantis get in?
Well, because I think the interesting thing is you have if Corcoran ultimately gets in this race, you have a really interesting perspective as far as a primary goes. You have obviously Putnam with pretty good name ID. You have Richard Corcoran, who as the speaker has shown his policy chops and his ability to get conservative policy done. And then you have DeSantis coming in kind of with the Trump endorsement, if you will, into the space. So I think it's a really interesting. There's kind of something for everybody in the Republican race right now as far as as far as policy or as far as politics.
I was looking at a poll yesterday that said that 80% of Florida Republican primary voters still support President Trump. So if you have Trump's okay, then wouldn't that make you the immediate front runner?
I don't know that it does. Not in this race. No, because I think you it really comes down to name ID. But and Putnam's been there, and Corcoran have been there. So I think it comes down to what is that individual Republican voter looking for in a candidate. And I think that there really is something for everybody in this slate.
Three conservatives, but who is the most conservative? Would you pick one as the most conservative?
No, I think they're all vying for that position. I think the question is, if you're looking for a policy conservative, look, Richard Corcoran has got it, has absolutely shown that he can get something done. Mm-hmm. And I think if you want somebody who is great on the stump, I think Adam Putnam is as good of somebody I've seen on the stump ever. And he's fantastic. And then I think if you're looking for somebody who's got the Trump endorsement, I think DeSantis is there as well. I think that's an honest perspective from a Republican member of the legislature of all three candidates.
Let me say one more thing, too. If you look at how Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio came from nowhere to win races, it was a tried and true strategy of going to all of the county party committee kinds of activities and raising money and so forth throughout the years. primary voters. We have a late primary. Primary turnout is very low, so you have sort of the party activists. So that is why grassroots, you know, definitely going around and mingling with people who have friends and neighbors that are going to vote is a real part of the calculation.
Putnam has already done that. So he's gone around to every county in the state, or practically every county in the state, held rallies, held meetings. He's been there. So is it too late for DeSantis to begin that process?
I don't think it's too late, but I do think that the idea that you can just rely upon a president and some wealthy people to take you to victory in a Republican primary is a little bit pie in the sky, at least right now.
You know, and I just want to add, I think Commissioner Putnam's really going to have to watch how he gets drawn and what direction he gets drawn on in terms of policy. When you have DeSantis and Corcoran and their conservative nature in a race, Putnam is going to get drawn to the right, and I think he's just going to have to be really wary of how far and how fast he goes, because we're all, you know, when the general election comes, it's a whole different ball game, and his attractiveness is in a general election from a Democrat's point of view, but in a primary, he's really going to have to watch kind of how he navigates running against some very conservative people.
And I think if he goes too far, he's going to get labeled as disingenuous. Mm-hmm. You know, he has some comments early in his campaign about being a fanatic for the NRA. You know, that
but
to me...
But doesn't that work in a conservative primary? If you're going after conservative voters, that's what you want to say, right?
It's a good position if that's where you've always been.
Right.
But if it's coming out of left field and it can be interpreted as disingenuous, it reminds me of Michael Dukakis getting in the tank and saying he was a big supporter of the military. I mean, it just didn't come across as credible.
Sean, I want to ask you one last question. That is, does DeSantis getting in the race make it less likely that Richard Corcoran, the House Speaker, is going to get in?
In my opinion, no. I mean, from what I can tell, Speaker Corcoran's going to get in the race. I know you asked Senator Brandis something. Look, I'm a member of the House. If you're going to ask me who the most conservative member person running, it would be Speaker Corcoran. It wouldn't even be close.
Okay.
But I mean, that's just because I'm in the House. But I don't think it lessens the likelihood. I think he's been preparing. I think he's doing everything that a person who is going to get in is supposed to do. And I think he gets in.
Okay. Well, Florida's Republican lawmakers say they plan to fast-track legislation that workers groups say would weaken most labor unions in the state.
The bill would require labor organizations to have at least half the employees of a bargaining unit paying dues to the union in order to maintain certification. House Bill 25 would target all unions except those representing law enforcement officers and firefighters. Opponents call it a union-busting bill. Supporters call it an effort to create more transparency. A similar bill failed last year. When the legislative session begins in a few days, it's likely to come up for a vote right away in the House.
So, Ernest, is this a good idea to make it easier to decertify unions if they have few members?
No, I don't think it's a good idea, but I think it's an idea born out of what we've been talking about. Who can establish themselves as the most conservative candidate running for governor? And I think Speaker Corcoran is backing this bill in an effort to show his conservative bona fides. And I think we're going to see some other bills of that same ilk. And not to put any pressure on Senator Brandis, but it's really going to be up to the state Senate to kind of be the bridge between two people who have political aspirations and are going to try to use this session to boost their chances of winning, Governor Scott and Speaker Corcoran. And the interesting thing is that they have very different budgets, very different proposals, because they have to position themselves differently. Governor Scott has to worry about appealing in the general. Right now, Speaker Corcoran is only worried about being right of right, being more conservative than Commissioner Putnam and Ron DeSantis. So those are competing interests. And who's in the middle? Jeff.
Last year, there was no bill in the Senate, as I understand it. Now there is a bill that's in the Senate. Is this a good idea for the state of Florida?
I think the interesting thing in the Florida Senate right now is that just because of some of the changes that we've had in the Senate in the last few weeks.
With Light Valley leaving?
Correct. The pathway to this bill going forward. I mean, understand, Senator Light Valley probably was the number one ally of the unions in the Florida Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And now that he's no longer in the Senate, the pathway for this bill just got a lot different. And And so I think we'll see how the negotiations ultimately play out between the House and the Senate. But I think this absolutely becomes a bargaining chip down the road for something that the House wants and that the Senate would be willing to negotiate on.
Generally speaking, is the bill a good idea for the state of Florida?
I think generally speaking, we have to ask a question. How many people should ultimately be contributing to the dues of a union for them to ultimately be bargaining on their behalf? Is it one per 100? Is it 50%? I think 50% probably is a reasonable amount to say 50% of people should be contributing to dues for them to be representing you in a bargaining unit. I think that's not an unreasonable ask.
Mm-hmm. Sean, what would you say about the bill? It looks like it's going to pass the House, right?
Well, a lot of things pass the House that I don't agree with. But I don't think this is a good idea. One, why is the legislature getting involved in this? Why is the legislature the one to decide what the right number is and what the wrong number is? The legislature represents less than 1% of the people in the state of Florida. So for us to be imposing this 50% threshold, I think is something that I don't think is good policy. I think it is union busting. And when I hear the word transparency in Tallahassee, I get very scared, because that word is used to justify very bad policy decisions across a wide spectrum of things. You know, in the name of transparency, we need to do XYZ, when usually doing XYZ does nothing to enhance transparency. So at its core, I don't think the legislature should be the one determining where the right percentage is for union dues. That is a decision that the bargaining people and the ones involved in there ought to be making. I don't want us to be top down telling unions what to do in that realm. That gets very concerning very fast.
All right. Well, the chairman of Florida's Republican Party, who is also a member of the state House, has drawn a challenger in the upcoming Republican primary.
Former Hernando County Commissioner Jeff Stabens has taken steps to challenge incumbent state representative Blaise Ingolia of Spring Hill for the House District 35 seat, which represents most of Hernando County. Stabens served three previous terms in the legislature and two terms on the county commission. He and Ingolia have been political foes for some time, according to the Tampa Bay Times. In his announcement, Stabens criticized Ingolia's time on the tournament poker circuit and called him a home flipper of questionable repute. Stabens has promised to limit campaign contributions to $50.
So, Jeff, does Representative Ingolia have anything to fear here?
So.
You don't think
so? I don't think so. Look, yeah. I think if you're in that community, he represents Hernando County. Blaise is by far the more conservative candidate in that race. If you believe that generally conservatives are going to win the primary, then up in that area, Blaise is the firebrand conservative. Plus, I mean, he's the chairman of the state party. He's going to have the name ID. He's going to have the presence to win in that race.
And Stabens, though, did serve in the legislature before. I mean, he's got a track record up there in Hernando County.
Yeah, I think I'm sure he does have a track record. I don't know him personally, but I think at the end of the day, I don't see him being a major hurdle for Blaise.
Okay, and you don't think it's a sign of anything?
I really don't. Look,
sort of insurgency within the party.
No. I mean, no more than people that are talking about. There's a gentleman talking about running against Audrey Gibson, who's the minority leader of the Florida Senate up in Jacksonville, against her in a primary. So I think that these things happen occasionally. They don't happen often, where you have somebody who's sitting in that chair, in that seat, who's going to get primaried from the left or the right of the party. But they do happen every now and then.
Okay. Well, before we go, what other big story should we look at? And this week we're going to ask, when the legislature begins in the next few days, what's the big story that you're expecting or that we should look at, Sean, Representative?
Well, there's two. It's the budget and kind of what we prioritize as important in this state. Look at the budget, and that'll tell you what the priorities are, whether it's public education, lack thereof, the environment, and also criminal justice reform. And Senator Brandis, you know, he's ought to be commended for his leadership role in this. This is a bipartisan kind of effort. A lot of us believe that this is necessary. We need to do this. We need to reform how we do criminal justice in Florida. And that's something I think we're going to see some movement on a bipartisan level.
All right. And Ernest, when the legislature meets, what's the big story that you're going to be looking at?
I think K-12 education is going to be an issue that's front and center. How it's funded, how it's been funded in the past, and does the funding formula need to change? And particularly for the Hillsborough delegation. We're in a county where the school district is struggling. Some of that is of their own doing. But It would be nice. I don't think it's going to happen, but it would be nice to see them pull together across party lines and try to put in some policies that are going to help our school district recover from the budget crisis that it's facing.
Well, I hear both of you talking about priorities and education being a big priority. And I got to ask Jeff about the budget in just a moment. Susan, what do you think is going to be the big story to watch when the legislative session meets?
Guaranteed, the whole sexual harassment issue is going to be a big one. But there's also another one that I see playing out, and that is the whole issue of local control, where some legislators who are going to be challenged, they already know it, and they're going to be pressured by people back home, local elected officials, local groups, to stand their ground and protect the rights of local governments. So I see a lot of, I'm really watching that tension between local politics and legislators who have already known opponents coming up.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jeff, what's the big story to watch for when the legislature meets?
So I think Sean was correct. I think it is the budget, and then I think it is criminal justice reform. I think the budget and discussion about required local effort and how that plays out this year between the House and the Senate, that's a big portion of the discussion. We've bought that back for the last few years and considered it a tax increase to let that go through. So I think that's a really important story and something that everybody should watch. The other thing is the overall discussion about criminal justice reform. I think it really is a time that we're seeing bipartisan support to really deal with this issue. We have 96,000 people incarcerated in this state, and I would argue we have guards for about 86,000 of them. Mm-hmm. We have, as the economy has improved, finding people to staff our prison facilities in the rural areas where they're located has become a real challenge for the state. I toured a facility just last week that had 1,100 inmates. It had one teacher in that facility.
Wow. Real quickly, we have about 15 seconds left, but with all the tax cuts under Governor Scott the last few years, is the budget picture improving? Are we seeing more money coming into state coffers?
We're seeing, I think the challenge is, yes, you're seeing more money, but you're also seeing costs go up. So healthcare costs, everything costs more every year, and so that consistently puts a challenge on the budget. Obviously, we have individuals coming from Puerto Rico. We have a major challenge on the education front. So we have a lot of different challenges.
Okay. Well, thank you all for a great show. And I think this discussion about the budget is going to come up over and over again the next 10 weeks.
Sure,
well, your comments are always welcome. Please write us at ftw@wedu.org and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You can watch this and past shows online at wedu.org.
That was Florida This Week from this past Friday night, and my guests on that program were Ernest Hooper, a columnist at the Tampa Bay Times, Dr. Susan McManus is a professor at USF, and Sean Shaw is a state representative from Tampa. He's a Democrat. Jeff Brandes is a state representative from Pinellas County. He's a Republican. Brandes is a state senator from Pinellas, and I think his district also includes parts of Hillsborough County. And our topics, oil drilling, Ron DeSantis' announcement that he's running for governor, the HB 25 bill that would decertify unions, and also the challenge to Blaze and Golia, the Republican chair, the chair of the Florida Republican Party. He is also a member of the State House in the Hernando County area. If you want to comment about any of these topics, you can email us right now here in the studio. dj@wmnf.org is our address. We're going to listen back to what Oprah Winfrey said last night at the Golden Globes Awards. And she was the first African-American woman to receive the Cecil B. DeMille Award, the big award last night for lifetime achievement at the Golden Globes. And she made a speech that a lot of people are talking about this today, including the talk is ranging toward whether or not she ought to run for president. So let's listen to Oprah Winfrey's speech from last night at the Golden Globes.
Thank you, Reese. In 1964, I was a little girl sitting on the linoleum floor of my mother's house in Milwaukee, watching Anne Bancroft present the Oscar for Best Actor at the 36th Academy Awards. She opened the envelope and said five words that literally made history. The winner is Sidney Poitier. Up to the stage came the most elegant man I had ever seen. I remember his tie was white, and of course his skin was black, and I'd never seen a black man being celebrated like that. And I have tried many, many, many times to explain what a moment like that means to a little girl, a kid watching from the cheap seats as my mom came through the door, bone tired from cleaning other people's houses. But all I can do is quote and say that the explanation in Sydney's performance in Lilies of the Field, amen, 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 amen. In 1982, Sydney received the Cecil B. DeMille Award right here at the Golden Globes, and it is not lost on me that at this moment, there are some little girls watching as I become the first black woman to be given the same award. It is an honor. It is an honor, and it is a privilege to share the evening with all of them, and also with the incredible men and women who've inspired me, who've challenged me, who've sustained me and made my journey to this stage possible. Dennis Swanson, who took a chance on me for AM Chicago. Quincy Jones, who saw me on that show and said to Steven Spielberg, yes, she is Sophia in The Color Purple. Gail, who's been the definition of what a friend is, and Stedman, who's been my rock, just a few to name. I'd like to thank the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, because we all know that the press is under siege these days. But we also know that it is the insatiable dedication to uncovering the absolute truth that keeps us from turning a blind eye to corruption and to injustice. To tyrants and victims and secrets and lies. I want to say that I value the press more than ever before as we try to navigate these complicated times, which brings me to this. What I know for sure is that speaking your truth is the most powerful tool we all have. And I'm especially proud and inspired by all the women who have felt strong enough and empowered enough to speak up and share their personal stories. Each of us in this room are celebrated because of the stories that we tell. And this year, we became the story. But it's not just a story affecting the entertainment industry. It's one that transcends any culture, geography, race, religion, politics, or workplace. So I want tonight to express gratitude to all the women who have endured years of abuse and assault because they, like my mother, had children to feed and bills to pay and dreams to pursue. They're the women whose names we'll never know. They are domestic workers and farm workers. They are working in factories, and they work in restaurants, and they're in academia and engineering and medicine and science. They're part of the world of tech and politics and business. There are athletes in the Olympics, and there are soldiers in the military. And there's someone else, Reese Taylor. A name I know and I think you should know too. In 1944, Reese Taylor was a young wife and a mother. She was just walking home from a church service. She'd attended in Abbeville, Alabama, when she was abducted by six armed white men, raped and left blindfolded by the side of the road, coming home from church. They threatened to kill her if she ever told anyone. But her story was reported to the NAACP, where a young worker by the name of Rosa Parks became the lead investigator on her case. And together, they sought justice. But justice wasn't an option in the era of Jim Crow. The men who tried to destroy her were never persecuted. Reese Taylor died 10 days ago, just shy of her 98th birthday. She lived, as we all have lived, too many years in a culture broken by brutally powerful men. For too long, women have not been heard or believed if they dared to speak their truth to the power of those men. But their time is up. Their time is up. Their time is up. And I just hope that Recy Taylor died knowing that her truth, like the truth of so many other women who were tormented in those years, and even now tormented, goes marching on. It was somewhere in Rosa Parks' heart almost 11 years later when she made the decision to stay seated on that bus in Montgomery. And it's here with every woman who chooses to say, me too. And every man who chooses to listen. In my career, what I've always tried my best to do, whether on television or through film, is to say something about how men and women really behave, to say how we experience shame, how we love and how we rage, how we fail, how we retreat, persevere, and how we overcome. And I've interviewed and portrayed people who've withstood some of the ugliest things life can throw at you. But the one quality all of them seem to share is an ability to maintain hope for a brighter morning, even during our darkest nights. So I want all the girls watching here and now to know that a new day is on the horizon. And when that new day finally dawns, it will be because of a lot of magnificent women, many of whom are right here in this room tonight, and some pretty phenomenal men fighting hard to make sure that they become the leaders who take us to the time when nobody ever has to say me too again. Thank you.
Well, that was Oprah Winfrey last night at the Golden Globes Awards ceremony. And if you'd like to comment about that, you can email us here in the studio at dj@wmnf.org. You are listening to Radioactivity here on WMNF in Tampa. We're going to give you one more soundbite that happened over the weekend. This one on CNN yesterday on the CNN program that Jake Tapper hosts called State of the Union. And we're going to listen to an interview that he did with Stephen Miller of the White House. This is White House aide Stephen Miller, who is one of the president's closest confidants. And we're going to listen to an interview that Jake Tapper did, all centering on the book written by journalist Michael Wolff that came out over the weekend about inside the Trump White House. So let's listen in on this interview from CNN yesterday. Again, if you want to comment about this, email us here at dj@wmnf.org.
Joining us now is the White House Senior Policy Advisor, Stephen Miller. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us and Happy New Year.
Thanks.
Good to see you.
Good to be here.
So President Trump and the White House have been calling the Russia investigation a witch hunt and a nothing burger. But obviously in this new Michael Wolff book, Fire and Fury, Bannon offered a different take on the Trump Tower meeting between Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort, and these other officials, including a Russian lawyer. He called it treasonous and unpatriotic. And he said that, quote, the chance that Don Jr. did not walk these Jamos up to his father's office on the 26th floor is zero. Did President Trump meet with any of the so-called Jamos who were in that Trump Tower meeting?
Steve Bannon's eloquence in that description notwithstanding, it's tragic and unfortunate that Steve would make these grotesque comments so out of touch with reality and obviously so vindictive, and the whole White House staff is deeply disappointed in his comments, which were grotesque. And with respect to the Trump Tower meeting that he's talking about, he wasn't even there when this went down, so he's not really a remotely credible source on any of it. It reads like an angry, vindictive person spouting off to a highly discreditable author. The book is best understood as a work of very poorly written fiction. And I also will say that the author is a garbage author of a garbage book. And the tragic thing about this book, and there are many things about it that are unfortunate, but the portrayal of the president in the book is so contrary to reality, to the experience of those who work with him, to my own experience having spent the last 2 years with him. You know, on the campaign, I had the chance to travel all across the country with the president on Trump Force One. It would be the president, me, Dan Scavino, Hope Hicks, a few other people, going from rally to rally to rally to rally. And I saw a man who was a political genius, somebody who we would be going down, landing in dissent, there'd be a breaking news development, and in 20 minutes, he would dictate 10 paragraphs of new material to address that event and then deliver flawlessly in front of an audience of 10,000 people.
So you were at the campaign during that Trump Tower meeting, I believe, right, in the summer of 2016. Just to answer the question, because you were there and Steve Bannon was not, did any of those people from that meeting meet with President Trump? As Bannon says, the chance that he didn't, Don Jr. didn't walk these Jamos up to his father's office on the 26th floor is zero. Can you just settle that for us? Did President Trump meet with any of the people?
I have no knowledge of anything to do with that meeting.
Okay.
But what I can tell you unequivocally is that the allegations and insinuations in this book, which are a pure work of fiction, are nothing but a pile of trash through and through.
Well,
just to finish, Jake, because you know your network's been going 24/7 with all this salacious coverage, and I know that it brings a lot of you guys a lot of joy to trying to stick the knife in. But the reality is that page after page after page of the book is pure false. I see sections of the book where events I participated in are described, and I have firsthand knowledge that as they're described, they're completely and totally fraudulent.
Nobody at CNN is sticking knives in anybody.
Right, but
there are a lot of people in the White House quoted in the book. I don't know why.
The quote that you're referring to is a quote from Steve Bannon,
right? Who was the president's senior strategist?
And I think that the president's statement on Steve settles once and for all the view about all of that.
Let's talk about that
Let's dig in though to your comment about he was also the president's chief strategist. So one of the other tragedies of this grotesque work of fiction is its portrayal of the president. The reality is the president is a political genius who won against a field of 17 incredibly talented people, who took down the Bush dynasty, who took down the Clinton dynasty, who took down the entire media complex with its 90% negative coverage, took down billions of dollars in special interest donations, and he did it all through the people and through his strategy and his vision.
So let's talk about his insight and his experience. Let's talk about it. The president is now calling Bannon, quote, sloppy Steve, and he released a scathing statement this week saying in part, quote, Steve Bannon has nothing to do with me or my presidency. When he was fired, he not only lost his job, he lost his mind. You worked hand in glove with Bannon at the White House and on the campaign. Is the president really arguing that Steve Bannon had nothing to do with him or his presidency?
I can only tell you my experience, which is that I joined the campaign in January of 16, before the first ballot was cast in the Iowa caucus.
Bannon helped you get that job. No?
Corey Lewandowski is the one who offered me the job in the Trump campaign. Mm-hmm. But just to finish,
Bannon wasn't helping you? Bannon didn't help you get that job on the campaign?
I think the person who probably helped me most get the job on the campaign was probably Corey. But the most important thing, because I've been working with Corey before I joined to try and help out with the campaign, but the most important thing to say about this is that the president's first speech that he gave, unfiltered, unscripted, that was Donald Trump. That's the same Donald Trump who for 30 years has talked about how America is getting ripped off on trade, on military deals, and everything else. It's the same Donald Trump who tapped into the pulse of millions and millions of Americans.
Right, but
a phenomenon that was happening that you didn't see, a phenomenon that was happening that the rest of the political class didn't see. All these so-called political geniuses in Washington, whether it be at the big lobbying firms or
the only
many
person
of the
who's called himself a genius
Congress,
in the last week is the president, but which
happens to be a true statement.
Okay,
a self-made billionaire who revolutionized reality TV and who has changed the course of our politics.
And he's happy that you said that. But
you know, Jake, you can be condescending. I'm trying to get to the point that
Steve Bannon.
You can be condescending. That was a snide remark. You're sure he's watching? And he's happy. Let me tell you something.
Why is
your
that
network?
Snide?
You can look, you can be as condescending as you want. It's part of your MO. But listen, you can have 24/7.
I have no idea why you're attacking me.
Well, I'll explain to you.
My point is,
I'll tell you why I'm attacking
Steve Bannon.
Jake, you can have a 24/7.
Help push the president's travel ban.
I'm so glad you brought that up because that's one of the fake news items in the book.
Steven,
I would happen to know better than you would, Jake, about how the travel ban was written. Steve Bannon didn't push the travel ban.
If you let me ask this question.
No, because you get 24 hours of negative anti-Trump hysterical coverage on this network that led in recent weeks to some spectacularly embarrassing false reporting.
I think the viewers right now can ascertain who's being hysterical.
No, the viewers are entitled to have 3 months of the truth. Why don't you just give me 3 minutes to tell you the truth about Donald Trump that I know and then all of our campaign staff
know? Because it's my show and I don't want to do that. So here's my question.
Settle down. Jake.
I have a question for you about issues. Stephen Bannon, who the president says had nothing to do with his presidency, he was part of the president's travel ban. He was part of pulling out of the Paris climate deal. He was part of withdrawing from the TPP. He's part of border security. He's part of being tough on immigration.
So you don't want to go through the list?
No, I don't want to go through, but my point is it really the position of the Trump White House that Steve Bannon had nothing to do with the presidency? Or can you acknowledge the reality that he was a key player?
I think that what the point is that his role has been greatly exaggerated, whereas the president hasn't gotten the due that he deserves for the movement that he put together to tap into the kinds of people whose life concerns don't get a lot of attention on CNN. Not a lot of hours of coverage on this TV talking about the working class construction workers who've lost their jobs to foreign labor. There's not a lot of coverage on this TV about the people getting slaughtered in sanctuary cities. You don't do a lot of human interest stories about immigrant communities under siege from MS-13. He tapped into a reality that is happening in this country that's not covered on this network. And I know you think I'm interrupting you, but I think the American people deserve to have 2 or 3 minutes of the truth.
And we've let you talk.
No, here's the truth. I travel with Donald Trump all across the country and the world. I would be with the president on a campaign plane with a rally in 20 minutes, and he would be
you've
able
already
to
made this
up,
point, Stephen.
He'd be able to come up with material.
Yeah,
in
you've
the
already
blink
made this. You've already made. You've already said that. We let you say that at the top. According to the New York Times, Special Counsel Robert Mueller has in his possession an early draft of a letter that you helped write in May 2017, detailing reasons to fire FBI Director James Comey. According to the newspaper, the first line of the letter mentions the Russia investigation. Did you write a letter outlining reasons to fire Comey and list the Russia investigation? Is that true?
Here's the problem with what you're saying. The final draft of the letter, the one that was
I'm not talking about that one. I'm talking about the one that Comey has that mentions Russia.
If you want to have an answer to your question and not to get hysterical, then I'll answer it. The final draft of the letter has the same line about the fact that there is a Trump-Russia investigation that this has nothing to do with.
So it was just moved from the top to the bottom?
No. Look at the letter. It's the beginning. The investigation is referenced in the beginning of the final letter that was released to point out about the fact that notwithstanding having been informed that there's no investigation, that the move that is happening is completely unrelated to that. So it was a disclaimer that appeared in the final version of the letter that was made public.
I want to ask you, because you obviously are very offended by the notion that this book, Fire and Fury, paints a picture of President Trump. Trump is not mentally up to the job. On Saturday, President Trump put out a series of tweets trying to defend himself on this issue of fitness. And he said, quote, "Actually, throughout my life, my two greatest assets have been mental stability and being, like, really smart. Crooked Hillary Clinton also played these cards very hard and, as everyone knows, went down in flames. I went from very successful businessman to top TV star to president of the United States on my first try. I think that would qualify as not smart, but genius, and a very stable genius at that." Do you think tweets like that help or hurt the cause that the president is stable and up for the job?
Not only do I think they help it, but I think in the toxic environment that you've created here in CNN and cable news, which is a real crisis of legitimacy for your network, and we saw it, of course, with the extremely fake news you reported about the Don Jr. and WikiLeaks story. That was a huge embarrassment for your network.
Stephen.
Just like the huge embarrassment you had when you got the Comey testimony wrong.
Stephen, I'm trying to get to the issue of the president's fitness, which a lot of people are questioning.
I'm getting to the issue of your fitness. But the president's tweets absolutely reaffirmed the plain-spoken truth. A self-made billionaire revolutionized reality TV and tapped into something magical that's happening in the hearts of this country. The people that
the president has approval rating in the 30s. I don't know what magical you're talking about.
the people that you don't connect with and understand, the people whose manufacturing jobs have left, who've been besieged by high crime communities, and who've been affected by a policy of uncontrolled immigration, those voices, those experiences don't get covered on this network. That's so, why, to prove the point, I was booked to talk about the very issues I'm just describing.
Well, we're out of time. That's Stephen Miller, who's a top aide to President Donald Trump on CNN yesterday, being questioned, interviewed by Jake Tapper. If you want to comment about anything you've heard here the past hour, you can call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. We'll play your comments tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned for the latest news and mid.